So this is not a play where you're watching a main character decide whether they're going to go through with it or not. It's the opposite. You're watching the people around this character having to navigate a decision that is pretty much final.
Hello, bonjour, shalom, and welcome to Culturally Jewish. I'm David Sklar.
And I'm Ilana Zakon.
On this week's episode, we chat with director Philip Aiken and playwright Jordi Mand on her new play, In 7 Days.
Mama always wanted me to be a doctor, but I became an artist and that really shocked her. Now I'm interviewing people in the biz, pros and newish, but all of them are artists and they're culturally Jewish.
Ilana, what's been going on in your world?
In my world, it's been very busy. Auditions are picking up. I don't know about you. You were totally right, by the way. The theaters are auditioning for their next season. I don't know if we talked about this off air or on air, but things have gotten busy. And now that the strike is over, film auditions are picking up. So I am in a totally different rhythm. And it's like me trying to catch up to this completely busy, you know, schedule that I haven't had in a long time. But it's all good. No complaints.
I'm glad you said I was right. I always like it when people can admit I'm right. I don't get that enough in my life. And you're right. It is a super busy for me as well. Next week, like multiple auditions every single day for all the next seasons. It is the time, right? Spring is happening and everyone wants to get their productions out and cast their shows next season. So we're in this very weird limbo feeling of everyone's asking us like, oh, what's next for you now that you closed the show? And I'm like, we'll wait and see.
Yeah. I feel you. So you got to partake in a really interesting conversation at your synagogue in Calgary. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. It wasn't my synagogue. It was actually, I go to B'nai Tikva, but this was Temple Beth Tzedek, the conservative synagogue in Calgary. Okay. And every month they invite someone, whether it's a lawyer or a business person. This time they asked me to come in to talk about sort of my background, how I became an actor and writer. And I decided to sort of talk about what it was like being a Jewish artist post October 7th. So I had a list of all my famous productions, a lot of Jewish roles that I've done, talk about what it was like playing that. And then sort of the conversation shifted halfway through to be like, this is where we're at today. It's a very disturbing, stressful situation where a lot of Jewish artists do not know whether they feel safe and supportive in a lot of spaces, as we've talked so much about on this show, where we're all on social media. We know what these directors and fellow artists are posting every day and saying about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, about the war in Gaza. So it's becoming this very uncomfortable space that we're now inhabiting, but especially anything to do with Israel and even things to do with Jews, nothing related to the state of Israel, is now toxic, right? Anytime you try to have a Jewish character, anytime you're doing a Jewish festival or event, it is now saying, will this be safe? Do we need security? Will we be protested and called Zionist scum and your lovers of genocide all the time? And it's happening throughout the arts world across this country.
And across the U.S. I mean, there's so much that's happened in the last couple of weeks, which if you didn't watch the Oscars, I'm not going to repeat everything that happened, but essentially a Holocaust movie won Best Foreign Film, The Zone of Interest, and the director of the film, who's Jewish, said that he refuted his Judaism. This is not a quote. I don't have the quote right in front of me, but he's refuting his Judaism because he referred to what's going on in the Middle East as being.
Hang on one second, Ilana. I just want to clarify exactly what he said, because I know so many commentators have sort of said, what? This guy is refuting his Judaism? Technically, that's not true. Sort of. It was a very awkward sentence, but what he was saying is, I refute my Judaism being used in this war, right? He doesn't want to sort of say, I refute my Judaism. I don't want the Holocaust to be used as a pretext for anything like that. You may disagree. And I think the issue, more than anything, it was poorly worded statement. And for someone who had the paper in his hand and for someone who's involved in the arts, it was a bad worded statement, but he was not saying, I am not a Jew. I refute my Judaism
of
this situation.
I'm not saying that he was like, I don't want to be a Jew anymore, but along those lines, he's like, well, I don't want my Judaism to be used in the context of what's happening in the Middle East. I don't know. The whole thing made me feel so uncomfortable, and it brought back up so many experiences that I've had recently just locally in the theater community. And people have talked about this. I was going to say, so there's this new letter that came out where more than 450 Jewish creatives in Hollywood, executives, professionals, they basically denounced Jonathan Glazer, the director of Zone of Interest, Oscar speech. And they were saying, well, we refute to be defined this way.
We refute your refutism, right?
I thought
is that
was
what's
great.
Happening now? Yes.
I loved the wordplay, but it made me feel so envious of being an American Jew, because I feel like there's so few Jewish Canadians that work in the industry that are like affiliated, that are willing to have these conversations. And there you have, you know, probably, you know, thousands of people in the arts who are willing to band together and actually openly decry what was said, because this is just not the time. And the fact that everyone clapped after he said it, and they, you know, we saw which people did it and which people were wearing their pins. And look, I get it. If you want to, you know, speak out against people being killed, that's one thing. But why does everything have to turn into like this big protest? Can't we just have the Oscars and not constantly be, you know, feeling unsafe and feeling like, oh, can I say this? Can I say that? And I just don't think that a Jewish director making a statement like that is helping our cause in any way. If anything, it's just, you know, activating the masses who are already so angry.
You know what? You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. If you say something, you'll be criticized. If you don't say something, you will be criticized. You cannot win in this type of environment.
Would you have said something like that? What he said?
I would have worded something differently, because it's like everyone knows, everyone in that room and everyone on TV is saying, what will people say about it, right? Everyone is questioning it.
Why? Why can't you just talk about the Holocaust for what it is? Like, why do we always have to make these statements of like, I'm the good Jew?
Okay, so yes, you don't always have to come across as saying I'm the good Jew, but people are expecting someone to sort of say, you made this movie, right, about silence, about how people don't address these things in the moment. And he wanted to bring up something to sort of say, this is what I feel. I don't feel we need to sort of say, don't say anything. You can never speak. This is just about,
movies. I'm not saying to be censored, but it just, I don't know. It rubbed me the wrong way, I have to be honest.
It rubbed many people the wrong way. It's not going to go away. I don't believe he's made a statement about it. I'm sure he will come out eventually to sort of say what he was trying to say. I don't think he'll go quietly. And this is just, again, the state we're in, where everything becomes toxic. Whether you speak or don't speak, you lose.
I just think it gives more people permission to be canceling things. You know, we saw it this week with the Hamilton Jewish Film Festival, which is now being quote unquote postponed to the spring. Let's see if it happens, because they said there was going to be protests and they were worried about the safety. But meanwhile, the Federation has said, how true is that? Are they just trying to silence Jewish voices? You see Matisse Yahu, his concerts keep getting canceled. So it's a weird time to be a Jew in the arts, as we all know. So I we'll see where we go from there, but it's not looking great. Well, let's change the conversation now and talk about something even lighter and brighter. How about death? You want to talk about death, David, with our guests?
I'm looking forward to talking about MAID and death and dying, medical assistance and dying. So this show, we've invited on to chat with us Philip Aiken and playwright Jordy Mann on her new play In 7 Days, which is a story about a daughter struggling to accept her father's decision to end his life via medical assistance in dying. Let's take a listen. Jordy, can you describe what 7 Days is about?
Yeah. A woman named Rachel, in her sort of early to mid-30s, shows up at her father's house, and he wants to talk to her about something. And over the course of their first interaction together, we learn that he is quite ill and that he has qualified for a medical assisted death and that he's decided to go through with it. And it's a Jewish family, and so the rest of the play sort of unfolds, and we see all the ways in which this decision has complicated this group of people, being Rachel, her father, her father's partner, Shelley, her father's childhood best friend, Rabbi Eli Limmer, who is involved in the story both from sort of a spiritual, religious, and familial way. And then eventually Rachel's ex-boyfriend Darren shows up. And so it's about how this decision impacts all of these people and sends them on their own unique journeys, and how it sort of brings them together and pulls them apart, and how they all have to learn how to say goodbye in their own way.
So this is a very heavy and also somewhat controversial topic. I would love to hear about the inspiration for the play. I read in one place that it was a conversation you had with your brother, and then David said it was a conversation you had with a friend. So clear this up for us. How did the play come about?
So it came together sort of, I guess, from a few sources, all of which are based on real and actual people. So my dad had a childhood best friend growing up. They were very, very close. And then when it got to sort of like university time, they both went to school in different cities and they lost touch. And then about a decade ago, my parents moved from Toronto to London, Ontario. And I didn't know anybody there. And so the first thing that they did was they joined a synagogue there. And somebody at the synagogue said, oh, you guys are from this area of town. You should meet our other member of our congregation who's also from that area of town. And it was my dad's childhood best friend. And they reconnected. But his health was really bad. And he qualified for medical assisted death. And he decided to go through with it. And at the time, he was the first person who I knew, first Jew who I knew, who in my life, who decided to proceed with this this path. And I didn't even realize until I sort of started working on this play just how controversial it is in Judaism. And so that was really the jumping off point. But then the conversation that you're alluding to is I was in London visiting my parents while this was sort of all happening. And there was lots and lots of ways in which people in the Jewish community in London expressed their support, expressed their concern, their anger, their distaste. It really ruffled people's feathers in a lot of different ways. So I was in London visiting my parents and I came back to Toronto and I saw my brother and he said, you know, how are mom and dad doing? And I said, they're not doing great. They're really struggling with this decision that their friend is making and all of the things that it's bringing up for people in their community there. And my brother said something along the lines of, yeah, I don't know how somebody could possibly go through with something like medical assisted death. I think it's one of the most selfish things that someone could do. And I was like, selfish? What do you mean? And he said, I don't understand how someone could do that to their family. And while I understood exactly what he meant, because I said to him, you know what? Okay, so what if dad's health was not great and he decided to go through with this? What about that? And he said, still, I don't understand how he could possibly make that decision. And, you know, I've had lots of health issues in my own life. Close family members of mine have had health issues. My husband has health issues. And so I really do understand what it means to have chronic pain in your life and to feel like you really don't want to keep living that way. And while I understood exactly what my brother was saying, especially the idea of processing, you know, the hypothetical death of your parent, I also completely understood why somebody would go through with something like this. And for me, anytime there's two opposing ideas about something, there's a play. So I knew that there was a play in here. And I basically, as soon as, you know, my brother left the room, I basically sat down to start writing in 7 days.
Fascinating. Philip, how did you come into this conversation and especially approaching it as a non-Jew with this very Jewish play?
Okay, so second part of the question first. I'm not really sure that being Jewish or not is actually the issue. I think all of my work is about bringing fully formed human beings onto the deck. And so there are traps with any kind of, you know, anytime you get a kind of an ethnic play, I guess. And so how do you avoid those traps? Like, how do you make this about real life human beings and not about stereotypes? So that to me is, you know, it's a no-brainer, really, in terms of that part of the question. I guess also, too, how did I get involved? I've worked with Harold Green a number of times. We've always had a good working relationship. We brought forth some interesting, difficult stories together. I like the guys like me. Jordy and they, you know, David and Avery said, hey, do you want to direct it? I said, yeah, man, I do.
Mm. I'm curious, what do you think are those traps then within the Jewish stereotypes or the Jewish tropes that you wanted to avoid?
Oh, they can be something as broad as I would often say to the actors, I say, this is not the Borscht Belt, right? This is not that wide, big, everybody know. You say, oi, and it's got to be. No, it comes from a different place. So I think that is one of the big traps. I was talking last night with my set designer. He brought me in to talk to his class of design students. And I said, one of the things that we really didn't do is that we didn't make part of the set decoration be a menorah, because that's a standard indicator. If you're Jewish, we slap a menorah and that'll go, you know what? You don't, it can be, there's a lot of Judaica that is personal and deep and rich in cultural history. You don't have to be slapping menorahs all over the place.
I love that.
So it's about avoiding the obvious and the expected, and getting rid of what I like to call, you know, stereotype, archetypes, prototypes, ambrotypes. You get rid of typism, and that will cut away those kind of traps.
And so going back to the controversial nature of this topic, what types of conversations did you have while workshopping the play over the last 4 years? Jordi, I'll start with you. With the actors, the team, what came up?
There were all kinds of things that came up. And I think for me, the most exciting conversations were around how the subject matter impacted people personally. I mean, for me, this is unabashedly a Jewish story. It's a Jewish family. And its difficulties and its nuances have so much to, for me, so much of that is steeped in what it means to be Jewish. But some of our actors aren't Jewish, and some of our, lots of our creative team was not Jewish. And the show had a run at the Grand Theatre in London in February and March before it's coming to Toronto, where the Harold Green Jewish Theatre Company is producing it. So there are, for me, even though it is about a Jewish family and about topics that are particularly topical in Judaism, I hope that people who are, that every type of person can come and see the show and feel like they can relate to it. And so the conversations we had in the room, especially while we were workshopping, were really around the things that resonated for people, whether they were Jewish or not. Mm. And, you know, people had, someone had lost their parents when they were a child. And so we talked a lot about how that impacted their journey growing up. Someone had just lost a parent. And so we were talking about that. We talked, you know, a lot of how my parents, we can talk about this if it's of interest, how my parents have decided to handle, I would say, like the last stage of their life has hugely informed A, my perspective on the world, but also the characters in this play. I feel like my parents have been preparing to die for like many, many decades. I don't know two people who are more organized and have been more thoughtful about how they want to leave this earth than my parents.
Can you give us an example?
Well, please do.
Yeah. You're like, wait a second, this has nothing to do with theater. I remember being, my mom had a really serious stroke when I was in high school. And that really contextualized a lot of how my parents specifically decided to deal with life planning of all kinds. My grandparents on both sides, my Bobby and Zadie's, all had major, major health issues. So I grew up in a household where it was very clear that the body ages and doesn't always age well. Like, one of the few things that we all have in common in life is that we're all going to die. We all know this. It's inevitable. Some people are much better about embracing that and preparing for it than others. And my parents have just prepared for it in the most graceful way possible. So, you know, my parents were the caretakers of my grandparents for many, many years, and were just put through the absolute ringer. And so my parents, honestly, just in the most elegant way, have tried to make the caring for them and the preparation for that caring for my brother and I as easy as possible. So I remember being 16. It was after my mom's stroke. My dad was like, hey, you want to come and hang out with me in the basement and talk about some stuff? And I was like, yeah, I love my dad. Yes, this is great. And we went into his office. I distinctly remember when he was like, okay, so here's where we keep the will. Here's all of the executor state business. Here's who you call. You are your brother's legal guardian until this age. You know, he went into the details with me and I was like, oh shit, wow, like things just got very real. And it's only sort of continued since then. And because some people, I think their attitude is, after I'm gone, it's other people's business to have to take care of everything that's left over. And other people think, no, I want to make sure that the people in my life have what they need so that they can grieve or they can get along. I've seen so many families, like nothing brings out the worst in families, I think, than weddings and funerals and death.
And the occasional bris, maybe.
Yeah. Depends on what wine people have had. You know what's so funny, actually? This is very, very funny. I've thought about a trio of plays. So the first one is in 7 days, which is about a death. The next one is about a wedding. And the third one is actually about a bris. So
oh, I love that. You should do it.
Reaching into the depths of my Jewish soul.
I want to direct the bris.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
So it's very, a lot of this kind of stuff came up, you know, when we were sort of workshopping the play, like how do we take care of the people around us? Do we have an obligation to take care of the people around us when we're facing death? It's really different, I think, when you are choosing when you are going to die, i.e. medical assisted death, versus passing away suddenly, passing away at a younger age. You know, all of that really makes a difference. So all of these things really, really fed into the, as Philip was saying, the humanness of the show. I certainly knew, I think, the most about the technicality and the legality and the Jewish circumstances around medical assisted death, just because I had been steeped in research and had been talking to people and doctors and rabbis. But the most helpful and exciting part for me were really like the human conversations that we had and how the ideas in the play were relating so directly to so many people's lives.
You know, it's very fascinating. My father passed away in October.
I'm so sorry.
And for maybe the past, no, thank you, I appreciate it. But for the past year or 2 years, we went over, this is his will, this is where the papers are, this is where the work is. However, you think you're ready for it, but when it happens, you are so not, and you're in this emotional state where you can't even take a breath sometimes to figure it out, right? Now, for me, I had a liver transplant when I was 12, I was very near death. Many people find this morbid, but I chat with my husband all the time about what we do in the event of the death. Here are the papers, where you go, what you're going to do after I pass away. Because I tell him I'm going to die first and you're going to be all alone. Now, some people consider that very morbid, but I consider it very realistic the way that Jordy was talking about it. We all die. And this is a process that we need to go through and talk through it while we're alive.
Wait a second here.
Okay.
You guys. because this is, every time we have these discussions and this comes up, I'm like Rabbi Eli Limmer in the play, where I haven't thought of it all. I haven't done any of it all. And I feel like such a schmuck because I haven't got the papers organized.
This is actually just an intervention, in Philip.
This is what it is. Philip, we're telling you it's time to get your will and
I'm
put in order.
Jewish News for help.
Thank you. Thank you.
But so much has to do, David, like what you're saying, you're a soul after my own heart. So much has to do with the context with which you experience illness and death. And for me, the people in my life who are the least prepared are the people who were not hit with the realities of death or the possibilities of death early. So my mom's situation absolutely colored, you know, basically everything that came after that for me. But I am a cancer survivor. I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer in my early 20s, one of the hardest experiences I've had to deal with. It was also like a huge roller coaster ride. And it switched a light switch on in me, which was, shit doesn't get easier. You're only going to get more of it. So you have to be prepared. And it's interesting what you're saying about your father, about like, you know, you can try to prepare for it, but you're really not prepared. And then imagine going through that process without actually anything in place.
It makes things 100 times harder. At least these things are in place that you can sort of say, I'm grieving, I'm distraught, but at least I can, if there's something tangible I can maybe hold on to and process and do the work.
Yeah. And it's, you know, this is a big part of the play for me. You know, sometimes people are like, what do you want people to leave with at the end of the show? And there's so many things, from like calling your family members who you love to say, I love you, because we only, as far as we know, have one life. And so let's make the most of it and tell the people that we love them. But also, I hope people who like don't have things in order go home and call a lawyer and try and get things sorted out, because this is one of the many gifts that Sam leaves behind for his family. He's already thought of everything. And so really everybody else is allowed to grieve because he's already made his decision. And so what's really interesting is a lot of people have said to me, was there any point in which you think Sam changes his mind, where he qualifies for medical assisted death, has decided to go through with it? Here are all of these people, the most important people in his life, really spend X number of minutes trying to convince him otherwise. Is there any point in time where they succeed and he changes his mind? And in my mind, he never does. He never wavers. He doesn't want to necessarily say goodbye to people, but there's no point in which he is not 100% confident that he is going through with this decision. So this is not a play where you're watching a main character decide whether they're going to go through with it or not. It's the opposite. You're watching the people around this character having to navigate a decision that is pretty much final. And so, you know, we sort of get to a place with Sam where there's this peace about him, especially because he's already made all of the arrangements. And so it means everybody else can grieve and he can leave knowing that he has taken care of people in the best way possible.
Philip, can you walk us through a bit of the behind the scenes of how you approached working on this script, whether in your prep or in the room with the crew and with the actors? Was there anything unique about this particular subject matter that you were like, I want to make sure that it gives off X and not Y, or I want to make sure people leave with what Jordy wants?
Well, that's it. I mean, it's the exploration of the text. I mean, Jordy writes in a particular style. A lot of fragmented sentences, and therefore it builds in an innate musicality to the text, and you have to find that, and it has to be clear, and it becomes really clear. I mean, it's just like listening to a concerto, and all of a sudden there's a missed note because somebody came in too early, too late, didn't complete the thought, etc. Yeah. So there's that kind of a build. The other thing, too, which took me, I guess, a little bit off guard was usually in theater, you rehearse 6 days a week. And I've always been a big proponent that we don't have enough time, so we rehearse. And you know what? We did 5 day weeks.
Oh, that sounds so good.
And it wasn't just the actors. It was, I remember a couple of times my stage managers just looking over at me on a Saturday, because we'd have the Sunday and Monday off. And she just said, thank you, I know we're all good in the room and we're all supportive and we're all working together, but it's just so wearing. And so I had to build in a space for a kind of an emotional recharge. And I didn't kind of expect that because, you know, a lot of the work that I've done has dealt with very difficult topics. But this one just, you know, it just hits people very, very deeply. I've done shows where, you know, people, you know, have been sad at the end and whatever. I've never been in a show where there's like, it's palpable, the effect that's having on an audience. I should also say too, because all of this sounds really dire, right? And it's not. And I believe the original kind of tagline slogan was, it's a comedy about death. And I thought one of the reviewers was actually quite brilliant. And they came up and said, no, that's wrong. It's a comedy about living. And I really want to stress that point, because in the struggle to live and to come to terms, there is great humor, right? And it's because of that humor. If this was just unrelenting, doer, dreary, oh my God, people going to die, going to die, going to die. I mean, this would be an awful evening. But it isn't. It's about surfing on top of that. It's about building to the last moment. It's about the journeys that everybody takes. It's about life going on. And I think that's what makes it such a powerful piece.
Philip, Jordy, I want to both thank you so much for coming on today. Can you give us a reminder of when the next production opens and closes and where it's going to be held?
In 7 days, it plays at the Meridian Arts Center in the Greenwind Theater from May 4th to May 16th, 2024. Tickets are available on the Harold Green Jewish Theater website. And we really hope that you all join us.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, David, what's happening in the Jewish arts world?
So on April 3rd at Beth Tikva Synagogue in Toronto, the Jewish matchmaker herself, Aliza Ben-Shalom, will be kicking off her Canadian tour. She's going to be offering all sorts of advice on dating, finding your match, and also providing tips on staying married, hopefully happily married. She'll also be helping four singles find love with a live matchmaking workshop. The show starts at 7:30, cocktails and VIP service at 6:30, where you can meet and greet with Aliza herself.
Very cool. So over in Montreal, there is a special workshop series that's coming up called An Introduction to Klezmer. It is a partnership between Klez Canada and LANEX, the Omet Center for Young Adults. And you're going to get to actually work with the musician from So-Called and learn how to do some klezmer. So that starts April 2nd. You can find the information on jlive.app. And back to you, David.
Thank you. So remember when we had Ari Gross on a few weeks ago to talk about his comic book Wardens?
Yeah.
There is now a walking tour coming up of the ward on April the 20th from 10 a.m. to 11:30. And basically what they're going to do is they're going to walk through the ward that basically Ari sort of describes in his comic book. And they're going to go through the history of what it was like with slaves who escaped through the Underground Railroad and eventually landed in Toronto, with Russian and Eastern European refugees, as well as the Jewish community, and how it sort of shaped over time to become more of Toronto's first Chinatown. So if you're interested, it is free. It is good for everyone, whether you're 8 or 80 years old, and you just want to get a bit of Toronto history. The tour will start at the Downtown Diversity Garden in Toronto, and then it will end at the Butter Baker Market Cafe.
Also in Toronto, though, it is happening on Zoom, so you can attend no matter where you are. There is a very important conversation, kind of going back to what David and I were talking about off the top of the show. It's a session for Canadian professionals in the film, TV, and music sectors to gather and share experiences and learn about combating anti-Semitism across the sectors. That's happening on April 4th at 12 p.m. And you can go on theculturacollective.com to find the information. It's also through UJA Federation of Greater Toronto.
Well, Elena, I just want to say break legs on all your auditions coming up.
You too, David. Let's kill it. Let's book some roles.
Hear, hear.
Culturally Jewish is hosted by me, David Sklar, and
Ilana Zakon.
We're produced and edited by Michael Freeman, and our theme music is by Sarah Siegel-Lazar. We're a member of the CJN Podcast Network. To support our work and everything the CJN does, visit the cjn.ca/donate to make a monthly donation and receive a charitable tax receipt.
Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.